So it's September 1st, as we record this. And James, I have to complain a little bit.
Finally, someone besides me.
Oh, I just, well, you know, I like playing the devil's advocate when you get all randy about the industry.
Yeah.
So, again, it's September 1st, but it just barely was August. And last week, I walk into a package store, and lo and behold, I see multiple brands of pumpkin beer out there. Pumpkin beer. And I know that Starbucks released their pumpkin coffee last week as well. And
wait, a pumpkin spice latte.
I think
it's a far, far cry from actually being coffee.
Well, okay, there's that. the pumpkin spice piece is what I think is important there, is at least they're willing to admit that there's no pumpkin in there. It's pumpkin spice, which is actual spice.
Yeah, nutmeg and allspice and clove.
So they don't pretend to make it pumpkin. So here's my problem with pumpkin beer at this time of year.
Okay.
And granted, the supermarkets are full of Halloween candy.
Yeah.
So I need you to do some math with me.
All right. Okay.
So last week, let's go back a week and a half. Let's say the beer was showing up canned and bottled on the 20th of August.
Okay.
Let's walk backwards from there. When did they have to finish that brew and start the canning and bottling process for that to get through all the logistics and get to the store by the 20th of August?
Okay, so let's walk backwards. You keep track of this. So 20th of August. So let's say, what kind of brewery is this? Are these like real local or is this like regional kind of stuff?
Oh, this is regional stuff.
All right, good. So 20th of August. So that means the distributor had it in hand by, I want to say, probably the second week of August.
Okay.
At the absolute latest.
So if the distributor had it then.
Yep. So then we walk back, say, all right, let's say these are ales, so they're relatively fast fermenting. So let's say that it was in the fermenter for, let's just say in the brew house for 3 to 4 weeks from start to finish.
Okay, so early to mid-July.
Right around the 4th of July, brewers were probably making pumpkin beer.
Okay. Do you know of anywhere in the United States where you're going to get fresh pumpkin on the 4th of July? Or did this all come from a can?
Well, that's a really good point. Let's talk about that. If they used actual pumpkin, then it would have been pumpkin puree. Mm-hmm. And pumpkin puree is exactly what it sounds like. It's pureed pumpkins that come from a special couple of varieties of pumpkin that have like ridiculously thick walls. Like you would need a reciprocating saw to carve these into a jack-o'-lantern because they're made for the pie industry and the puree industry. Because they are like a baking/food ingredient, they are relatively low in sugar. And as a result, they don't taste necessarily all that great. You know, you're cranking open cans and you're dumping them in the fermenter or wherever, right? And you're making this goo. The best, most palatable, I would say, pumpkin beers are made by taking usually very small, sometimes they're called munchkin pumpkins. They're very small. They're about, 8 to 10 inches in diameter, maybe even smaller. And they're relatively thick walled, but they have a higher sugar content. And the good brewers, the small ones, will split those open and roast them to caramelize those sugars before they brew with them. And that will give you a really deep pumpkin pie kind of pumpkin flavor without, you know, adding a bunch of excess sugar and spices. Unfortunately, you can't do that on a large regional scale. So they're either using extract or they are using pureed processed pumpkin.
Blech.
Which is why most of those beers don't taste like any. They taste like over spiced beer, and there's very little pumpkin because the puree they're using doesn't have much flavor.
Yeah. I mean, I love pumpkin flavored stuff. We've got pumpkin Cheerios in the house right now, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I've stopped buying pumpkin beers because they're never good. The only one I've ever really enjoyed, I had out by you years ago. And I remember you holding on to that because it was just such a good beer.
And that was,
I don't know if you recall.
I do. That was from Potosi Brewing Company. And that was one of those scenarios where they used those small munchkin pumpkins and they cut them and they roasted them. And they used a light hand when it came to pumpkin pie spices, which, you know, if you look at the spices that are mixed up in those blends, they are super potent. And a little goes a really long way. And most brewers just way overdo it. Just way overdo it. But 'tis the season, like it or not. I mean, honestly, this about the same time brewers started making Oktoberfest beers.
I saw one or two of those the other day as well.
Right. So, and those take a little bit longer to ferment. So, like I know New Glarus with their Staghorn Oktoberfest, which is fantastic. You know, it was right about the end of June they start brewing that beer. So it's ready to go and in stores, and I almost picked up a six of that today.
And it's the market.
Yep.
It comes back to some degree to the conversations we've had before about the IPA boom and brewing what your customers are asking for. But man, oh man, I mean, see, personally, I'd much rather have a beer with fresh roasted pumpkin in it and not see it until November. But at the same time, I would imagine most consumers are going to see a pumpkin beer in November and think, oh, that's been sitting here a while at this point.
Right. I mean, about the earliest, certainly in this hemisphere, that you're going to get pumpkin, even processing pumpkins, is probably August, the earliest. So then that would mean your beer's not rolling, hitting the shelves until October. And you've lost probably 3 to 4 weeks of sales because of that. But like the, you know, the vintage, Scott, we've had him on before. He won't come out with his pumpkin beers until probably the first part of October because he uses actual pumpkins.
And is he actually bottling that and getting it into distribution, or that's just in the tap room?
It's usually just in the tap room just because of the volume of pumpkin he has to roast is pretty ridiculous. So there is really, you can't go into distribution with that. So there's another plug for your local, you know, tap room and microbrewery to go to the brewery to get those specialty beers, the one-offs that, you know, just are either too expensive to make for distribution or just logistically not really viable.
Yeah, maybe that's the answer there, is that stuff like that just doesn't belong in wider distribution due to the timing.
Yeah, I mean, the same could be said for Christmas beers, right? So it's really, what's Christmassy about a Christmas beer? It's the spices they toss in it. And you could make that beer at any time. There's really nothing special about a Christmas-type beer except for the spices, whereas a pumpkin beer, well, it's got pumpkins in it. And if you want to have the best flavor, the best aroma profile, you use fresh pumpkins and you roast them. That is calendar restricted.
So anyway, that was my aggravation last week.
I can appreciate your aggravation.
Thank you for humoring me and building the calendar out so everyone understands the truth about the pumpkin beer that they're drinking right
now. The secret dark truth of pumpkin beer.
We're all about the truth.
And it's a love it or hate it sort of thing. I don't know anybody who's like, meh, it's all right. No, people are like, oh, I love pumpkin beer. And other people are like, bleh.
I love the concept of pumpkin beer.
Yeah.
Pumpkin coffees are the same way with me. I always love the idea, and I'm invariably disappointed.
Well, look at the family of plants that that the pumpkin is in. It's in the cucurbit family, so it's in the same family as zucchini and squash and cucumbers and things like that. And not really known for robust, intense flavor. Kind of survival food, more or less.
Survival food.
Although, you know, I could see a cucumber and like a cucumber and sea salt goes, but if I see a pumpkin goes, it's all over.
Ooh, yeah, I can't even imagine how that's going to work.
I will get stabby. And it's stabbier, I guess. Yeah.
So we've managed to blow 10 minutes talking about pumpkin beer.
Nice.
And I'm just going to take your thunder right now and say getting the pumpkin correct is a critical part of this process.
Did you just say critical?
I did.
Ah, damn it. It is true. It is very important.
So before we get into the big topic of the day here, one other thing. We've mentioned before, we put it on Instagram, we are running a contest. We want to get feedback from those of you who are looking at starting your own hop yard, and give us some information about who you are, what your background is, what kind of land you've got, what your plans are, and let us do a little dissection on the air of what your plan is and how we can help point you in the right direction. And that direction might be a complete 180 about face, but we want to give you the right direction.
And even folks that are, you know, if you've already got, you know, a few hundred plants in the ground and you think you want to go big time, you know, we include you in that. Take the plunge and let's have an honest discussion about your fate.
Yep, we'll always shoot straight with you, even if you don't like what we have to say.
What has that ever stopped me?
Never.
Never.
Never. So please reach out to us on that. What else have I not mentioned in a while? iTunes, you know, give us some likes, give us some comments. We're getting a lot of good feedback now, starting to flow through on Instagram and comments on the website. Keep those coming so we know if you want to hear what we have to say. Otherwise, it's just the two of us talking to each other, and we can do that without wasting disk space.
And it's, yeah, right. And it's been helpful. Folks have been asking for topics. And, you know, that's great, because there are some things that obviously, if we want to push Greg's button, we'll talk about pumpkin beer. But if we want to know what you guys want to hear, and give us some ideas. And there's a few that we've got in the waiting in the wings here that are really good. And before we went on to record today, we, Greg and I, hashed out two or three new episodes just based on some comments that folks had. So keep them coming.
Yep. And so we're going to get into talking about harvesters today.
Oh boy.
Yes. And to your point, James, we had a comment on Instagram a few weeks ago. Hey, when you guys talk about harvesters, can you talk a bit about some of these mobile, smaller, the non-wolf harvesters, and what's going on with them? Are they worth it? That sort of thing. And it really wasn't something we had considered getting into, but again, a listener brought it up, and we will absolutely make that part of this conversation, because especially now as the season's winding down, you're starting to see those come up for sale. People are trying to get rid of them secondhand, and we will get into the pros and cons of some of the models that are out there and what you should be aware of. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's folks in the Southern Hemisphere who are just gearing up. And so, you know, they've got it on their mind. So we might as well talk about harvesters today.
Yep.
Okay.
And Hilltop Hops Farm, by the way, are the folks that asked about the smaller harvesters.
Yep.
So thank you.
Yep. We're going to talk about them today. So what do you want to know? We should start it off by saying, so you tried harvesting by hand, and you don't want anything to do with it. And so what are your options, right? There's these whole plethora of reinventing the wheel harvesters, small ones. There's the used Wolf machines. There's the new Wolf machines in Downhauer. And then there's the DIY, build it in your garage, basement, workshop sort of thing. And all of those are different means to the same end, which is getting cones off of binds by doing the least amount of damage, but also being way more efficient than hiring 40 drunk hippie mm-hmm. vegans to come work in your hop yard.
40 drunk, I'm writing that down for an episode title, 40 drunk hippie vegans. And, you know, you said having it done more efficiently and all that, and we'll get into the details here, but it's a very important balance between doing it fast and doing it completely and with a minimum of damage.
Right. So, and those things sometimes are mutually exclusive of one another. Yep. And so it's really walking a fine line. I have seen some things. I say things because I hesitate to call them machines. I'm not exactly, they're more like maybe metal sculpture with some motion that terrified me. And this is coming from a guy who built something called the Mangler. So, and then I've seen, you know, exquisite pieces of machinery that have decades and decades of iterative engineering and redesign behind them. And ultimately, if things are balanced correctly in any harvester form, what comes out the back end is clean cones, and what comes out the side is garbage. So they all do the same thing. And for folks kind of curious, you know, what makes all of these different harvesters different? You know, I say, well, all these harvesters, are they really different? No, they're not. Ultimately, it comes down to three things. It comes down to removing the cone from the bine, without destroying it, right? Without shattering it. And then the rest of it is cleanup. So, because you're also going to strip off gobs and gobs of leaves. So now you want to get rid of the leaves out of the cone stream. And it's a two-step process. The first step is what we call air classification. Hop cones are dense and spherical-ish as compared to their, and so they have the least amount of surface area for their volume. So air tends to flow around them as opposed to big flappy leaves that get blown all about. So air can very quickly separate 95% or more of the garbage that is in the cone stream from stripping. That attribute right there, the air classifying, is the number one reason most small mobile harvesters on the market today are junk. I said it, you heard it. They do not do anywhere near what they advertise for yield, because stripping is the easy part. It's sorting out all the leaf and stem debris from the cones that takes a lot of tweaking and redesign and effort. And frankly, you can't package that efficiently in a machine that you can drag around from site to site to site. There's a reason why a Wolf 140 is the size that it is. It's because it works fabulously. Take that and condense it down into a machine that's half or a third of the size and still claim that you can process 140 binds an hour. It's total bullshit. It's just not going to happen.
And this is coming from us who built and sold machines for a while.
Correct.
And machines that we used on our own farm, and we tried to get around these limitations. That's how we learned about the limitations, was trying to build through mm-hmm. them. To your point, we had multiple iterations of the Mangler and the Mangler 2 and the Mangler Junior. No one ever actually got mangled, but there were some close calls.
It was kind of brutal. Well, it's because that stripping portion is what everybody sees because it looks the most violent. But that's not really where the business is happening. The business is happening in the number one, the air classifier. And then number two, we call the dribble belts. And those are the ones that everybody sees that they think, oh, okay, so I just have to strip. And then I'll have all these inclined conveyor belts to do all my polishing for me. To get the leaves, and because the round cones roll downhill and the flat leaves, you know, get carried up and over. Those dribble belts are only there to perform a final polish. They are not there as the primary source of sorting and classification. You look at these small mobile hop harvesters, and if they have any air classifying in them at all, it's an afterthought. It's a fan or something trying to blow some leaves away off of a flat bed of debris, and that's not the way you want to do it. And then they overload these dribble belts with cones and leaves, and they've got like three little dribble belts. Some of the Downhauer machines, the multi-million dollar machines out west, you know, the kind of machines that they build, and then they build a building around the machine. They'll have 20, 30, 40 dribble belts in line just to get things polished. So you think your three little dribble belts coming right out of the stripper is going to clean up your hop cones? No, it's not. So the thing all of those machines need in them, which none of them have, at least efficiently, is an air classifier. That single addition would turn those machines into something that actually is reasonably efficient.
I always think about that whole aspect of building a building around a piece of equipment when I'm throwing a tarp over my lawnmower. it just puts things at a good level of perspective and scale mm-hmm. there.
Yep. So those are the three steps in hop harvesting. It's stripping, it's air, and then two steps of cleaning. And number one is air classifying, and then number two is polishing, and that's where the dribble belts come in. And that's it. That's all that's there. Now, how you control all three of those things is really critical, because you have to have each step in tune with the other, or else you're going to get a bottleneck somewhere. So, like I said, stripping a bind is the easy part. There's picking teeth available, fingers available. There's all kinds of different ways that folks go about doing this, but you can strip way faster on a machine like a Wolf harvester that's got, let's say a Wolf 140 that's got six spinning, plucking drums, you could strip way faster than the machine can sort. Just by thinking, oh, I'm going to turn this thing all the way up as fast as I can get it to go, because that's going to be the most efficient. No. Yeah, you're going to run a bunch of binds through there, but your machine's going to be so overloaded that the air cannot do its classifying and blow the leaves away, and the dribble belts get overloaded and can't sort anymore. And so what you end up getting a bunch of cones going out in the garbage.
I imagine you also run the risk of shredding the cones because you're moving too quickly, of not clearing the bind completely because you're moving too quickly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People say, I just saw on Facebook this week somebody was posting pictures or asked a question. This is my first time running a Wolf 140. How do I know I've got it? You know, what should the bind look like coming out the other end? Because there's still a lot of cones on it. Well, if that's the case, then you don't have the machine set correctly. There should be less than 1% of the cone mass remaining on that bind when it's run through the machine. I don't care what machine you're using. Those cones should be very close to the center of the bind, and all the sidearms should be naked. But that isn't to say that you've got the machine adjusted and you're moving your picking drums so close together that they're almost touching. And when that happens, you end up shredding cones and breaking them apart. And that can cause shatter, and that can cause cause cone loss, because that cone, instead of being nice, dense, little round sphere, is now busted open with its bracts hanging out there. And the wind and the air classifier can grab it and suck it out and take it into the garbage.
Okay, I'm just writing down, leaving your bracts hanging out in the wind is the backup title.
Okay, all right, that's a good one. So having those things orchestrated, those three steps orchestrated together, is really where your efficiency comes in. Because it's not about the number of binds that you move through the machine. It's also about the yield of cones, clean cones coming out, you know, the good side. And the percentage of cones that are going out in the garbage just because of just attrition. You're going to have that. It's never going to be perfect. That's the trade-off that you have when you're doing mechanical harvesting, is you're going to lose some cones.
And, you know, we've discussed the fact that when you're running a farm, you need to be able to trust other people and put them in charge of various places. And this is one of those situations where you need someone with their eyes on this process and to adjust as you're going along. It's not a set it and forget it process by any means.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's not I have a harvester now, so everything's going to be awesome. No. That harvester is a clockwork mechanism, and you need a watchsmith there in order to make sure it's running just right. For instance, with our harvesters, I didn't watch them. I listened to them because I knew what it was supposed to sound like, because there's too much to look at. You can't be on all sides of the machines at once, but you can hear it running. And when it's not making the right sound, you know something's wrong. Then you learn what that sound is, and you become a little bit more attuned to it. Like, I knew when my chopper knives were getting dull. The chopper was a little like hammer mill up on top of the machine that would chop up the bind after it came through. And so it would just, go out in the garbage. Or when it was unbalanced because maybe it had too much gunk build up on it. You learn to hear those differences in vibrations and pitch and tone, and that's how you know there's an issue, not by running around looking at everything.
So in the biography I'm writing about you, would you prefer the harvester whisperer or the hop whisperer?
I'm not sure. I don't think there's anything whispery about me.
Well, I plan to publish it posthumously. Anyway,
oh, okay.
So you don't have to worry about being embarrassed with whatever.
Oh, no, I'm not embarrassed. I just think bald, grumpy dictator is a better descriptor of me than the hop whisperer.
But I just picture you sitting there with your ear next to the harvester.
Yeah, through my foam earplugs, through my over the ear earmuffs, because damn, it's loud. Okay, so we talked about the three basics of any hop harvester. Let's take a look at what you're really going to have at your disposal. You've got the used Wolf harvesters, which ours was from '72, and she ran like a champ. And loved her to pieces. The Baroness was her name. Really, the only evolution that's happened to those wolf harvesters over time is they've refined the dribble belt technology. So they've added maybe more dribble belts, or maybe they've changed some fan sizings on the air classifier. But other than that, the basic design hasn't changed because it works. Anybody thinking that they're going to reinvent this wheel and find a new way to harvest hops, more power to you. I'm not going to say you're not going to be able to do it, but you need to look at what's worked. And the most successful home-built machines look to what has worked. The stripper drums work great. So spinning drums with fingers on them. Some of the newer wolf harvesters, the larger ones, use curtains of like conveyor belts turned vertically with fingers on them that have a raking motion down. Much higher throughput machines than the drums, but drums are easier to deal with. Spinning things around an axle is easier to deal with than tracking a big belt. And really, it's about the width of the machine, how wide it becomes. It's not so you can get more. It's not like the bind or the arms, side arms are getting any wider. It's about how wide the belt is that all the cones get sorted on. So the wider the belt, the more throughput you can have through it. Making a belt longer, like a dribble belt, making it longer doesn't get you anything. You need width in order to get good cleaning action. Same thing with the air classifier. So you want to run all of that volume of hops. You know, you don't want a really concentrated, narrow stream of hop and debris going into an air classifier. You want to spread that out so the air has a chance to blow all the leaves and debris up and outward. So you want that field to be wide as well. So wider is better. I would say that you look at how the bind gets through the machine is something that a lot of people get hung up on. And there's usually some sort of a mechanism. It's usually a pinch chain. So you've got a chain that's running inside of a track. And sometimes it's got a clip on it. Sometimes it's got what we call pickup blocks on it. And really all it does is you stick the end of the bind in a hole in this track where the chain's moving across, and you wait for a pickup block to come by. And all it does is grab the bind and pinch it between the block and the steel channel that the chain is riding in. It just drags it through the machine. Keep it simple. Don't overthink it. You're going to have too many different points of failure to deal with. You want to keep it simple so that when something does break, because it will a lot, you want it to be simple and not something stupid, custom, or difficult to fix.
So are there other, you know, the Wolf is the industry standard, certainly.
Right.
Are there other models out there folks should look for? And I think another thing we can get into here is how do you find them?
Right.
Especially the used ones.
So there are other models. There are some smaller scale harvesters that were made not for very long. I think they went out of business in the 60s, late 60s. The name escapes me right now. You heard me mention Downhauer. They're the gigantic, massive monsters. So you're not going to be picking one of those up cheap. Really, it comes down to Wolf, and that's what you're looking for. Where do you find these harvesters? There are some folks out there that have made a business of finding old harvesters and refurbing them. And there are obviously people who have gotten in the game and then are getting out, or they're upgrading. Let's say they start off with a Wolf 140, and then they said, well, you know what, I need a 220 because I have too much hops, so I need something a little bigger. And the advent of social media has been a boon for the hop grower because, you know, before that, it was almost impossible to find, you know, used stuff. It'd have to be a friend of a friend of a friend. But now, you know, on social media, there's all kinds of groups that one can join and put feelers out there and even just search online for, you know, used Wolf harvester, and boom, you're going to find them. Now, granted, they've doubled in price since we started. So we were a very early convert to the Wolf, and we had one that I think it was, I don't know, maybe the fourth or fifth Wolf harvester in the U.S., used Wolf. And, you know, we brought it over and paid about $35,000 for it, shipped. But now that same unit will go for double that. But it works. And people say, well, that's too much money. I can't afford that out of pocket. No, neither could we. I went and got a little equipment loan for it. What are you thinking? You're not going to buy this stuff out of pocket. If you are, why are you growing hops? Give me your money. go get a loan. It's called farming, people. It's not a hobby at this scale. So I would highly encourage people, if you want to do this and you're going to do this even semi-pro, you need to get an appropriate harvester. And the first thing I would look for, I would exhaust every single angle I possibly could with finding a used Wolf harvester before I invested in any smaller mobile machines for, you know, half the price. You get what you pay for.
Yep, very true in most things.
Mm-hmm. That's just the sad part of it. You know, you want to be a farmer, then you have to buy the equipment. Do you think a dairy farmer or a row cropper goes out and pays for a brand new tractor cash in hand? Hell no. And why? That would be very poor use of your money when you can go and finance it and have that interest as a write-off, than to go take your money that's already been taxed and shell it out on a piece of equipment that you can't then take the depreciation on. So these are parts of running a business, not a hobby. Hobbyists, you know, we start looking at tools for our hobby and we think of how much is it going to cost me out of pocket to buy X, Y, or Z. In a business, you look at it and say, what's the financing rate on this? And what are the terms and how long do I have to pay it off?
And you can't... Go ahead.
Because a couple of $100 a month to have the right tool to give you an edge is way smarter money than trying to scrounge up and do whatever you have to with your home equity line of credit, for God's sakes, and go out and buy a $25,000 or $30,000 small machine that only does part of the job you need it to do.
Mm-hmm. And you compare that against what you would be spending on hand harvesting.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the lack of efficiency there and the lack of, you know, we've talked about the lack of reliability of getting labor in, mm-hmm. and all that. And it becomes a bargain when you really run the numbers, mm-hmm. to do this right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, my grandfather used to tell me all the time, it's like, you know, you buy the best tool that you can afford. You know, you don't have to go out and buy the absolute shiny, brandiest new thing. Hey, if you want to do that, go buy a brand new Wolf 515 for $700,000. It'll take 2 years to build because they're all one-offs, but you could do that and it would certainly do the job and you'd get a couple of Germans to come over and help you set it up. But
Or we could do it.
Or we, yeah, no. Not doing that.
Anyone who's got $700 to spend on that, I'd like to have a conversation with,
mm-hmm. There are more out there right now than... I don't know what else to say. I would say that if you're going to build your own, you need to take a look at what a Wolf harvester does and scale that down to your size. And do not skimp on the air classifying because it will screw you. Don't pay so much attention to the whirly spinny bits that do all the stripping, because that's all known technology. It's the dark art is in the separating.
What's interesting about all that to me is that it's not something where... it's not going to work. I mean, you'll put it all together, you'll start running it and say, wow, this is working. And it's not until you start measuring your efficiency rates, at which point it's too late, that's when you'll realize that your air separation isn't doing what you need it to do.
Yeah.
It's going to appear to work properly.
That's correct. And here's the kicker. If you're going to build your own, you get one shot a year at this. Mm-hmm. That's it. So if you're lucky and you have other people out there that are going to continue to hand harvest, because you're going to need them until you have your machine dialed in, that you might be able to make some tweaks and get a second go at it. But really, you get one shot a year.
Yep. And there's nothing good to run as a test.
No, believe me, we've tried.
Yeah.
We have tried, and...
There was one suggestion Dan had, but it was more expensive than actual hops. Carnations?
Yeah, something like that. Like, yeah, okay. Why don't you go out and spend that money? That's about it. I don't know what other specifics people would want to know.
Well, you mentioned in terms of finding one. So social media is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
from that perspective to see what's out there. You know, and whether it's a Wolf or one of these smaller brands, it's no different than when you're buying a car. If someone's selling it, they have a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Be savvy about that. Ask the right questions.
Yeah.
If they're getting out of the hot business, why? If they're upgrading, why?
Yep. Ask them, so here's something. If you're going to look at one of those smaller units, ask them the following questions. What was their average yield per plant? How did they find the machine worked on different varieties? Because from what I've seen, at least in field days and whatnot around the U.S., where some smaller growers have these units, is that the binds they're running through these things are what I would consider probably a quarter to a third of the yield that they should be. So the plants are smaller. And I remember the first time I ran up on one of those machines and I looked at it and all I thought was, my God, if I stuck a single Brewer's Gold bind through there that yields 2.5 pounds dry, the thing would choke. I'm just choke. And so that right there told me everything I needed. Those machines are built for people who are not getting commercial yields. So when they say, yeah, I can run 140 binds an hour through one of these things compared to a Wolf, right. And if I took that same bind you're running through that mobile unit at 140 and stuck it in my Wolf, I'd probably be running about 300 just because they're so small and scrawny. So when people use bind numbers to measure sort of harvest rates, you need to ask questions about what kind of bind. Were these scrawny Brewer's Gold or were these monster Chinook plants? And usually with the smaller units, you're going to find that, oh, well, you know, we haven't dialed it in and we could only test on small plants. I would say the numbers that most manufacturers give for those smaller units, you need to cut them at least in half if you're going to talk about commercial yield plants.
I think I would also want to know max hours in a day they've had it running.
Oh, sure. Yep.
How long can it run? And how many bodies do you need on the machine at all times?
Right. I've seen, again, because they lack that air classifying, I've seen those machines have 5 or 6 people lined up on the outfeed just sorting trash out. What have you gained yourself? It's supposed to be a labor saver, but you still have to have, you know, 8 people running the harvester. 6 of them are picking out garbage and people out in the field harvesting plants and bringing them in. So what have you saved yourself compared to, you know, I understand, I'm going to say it again, a used Wolf machine that's dialed in well, and you have 2 people. These things are not apples to apples when you're comparing them, and don't let anybody try and convince you otherwise.
Yeah, as you said before, you get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
You got this podcast for free. So,
oh, yeah, you know. Well, I know. See?
Put that into perspective.
And it was worth every penny they spent. Mm-hmm. Way more efficient than hiring 40 drunk hippie vegans.